Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. Here we are. It's April 8th, 2014. I love this month. It's my birthday month. So my birthday is on Earth Day, April 22nd, and you're more than welcome to send me happy birthday wishes on my birthday. You can do that at info@realmeals.org. That's my email address. And I would love to hear from you. Now, I say that from time to time, but I really, really mean it. And one thing I really want to know, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I've been doing this program now for 5 years. 5 years talking about my favorite subject, food, with so many wonderful experts in the plant-based food movement. And I want to know a little bit more about what you're thinking about this program as we age, as we grow, as we get older. Are we doing the right thing? Are you liking what you're hearing? Do you want to hear more of one thing or another? Can you please let me know? info@realmeals.org is how you do that. And I look forward to hearing what you have to say. Now, another thing that you can do, some of my listeners do this from time to time, and I love it, is you recommend people for me to talk to on my program. And I have to tell you that my 8-year-old niece made a recommendation, and the next person that I am going to be speaking with right here on this program today is the person she wanted me to talk to, and I'm really glad that she did. So, let me introduce my first guest, Lisa Soriano. She is a certified nutritionist holding a master's degree in nutrition and food science, specializing in school food service as the director of operations for JC Food, a premier school food service consulting company for independent schools in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And she founded the evidence-based nutrition education program, Veggiecation, that introduces thousands of American children to the delicious world of vegetables. As a school food service expert, she serves as co-chair of the board of directors of the New York Coalition for Healthy School Food. We know that wonderful nonprofit, right? And they work in partnership with New York City's Department of School Food to improve the health of New York State students. And there's so much more about Lisa Soriano, and we're going to find out right now. Welcome to It's All About Food, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen.
Yes, well, I love what you're doing because somehow Americans especially, and it's becoming more and more contagious around the world where we're forgetting how to eat, what to eat, how to prepare our food, what we should be doing, and it's detrimental to all life on Earth, not just humanity, but our whole planet.
Extremely detrimental. Yep, we need to reverse this trend.
And one of the best ways to do it is to start with children.
I believe that strongly, which is why I started my program.
I remember my sister's son, when he was about 5 years old, I remember asking him, where do apples come from? And he said, Publix, which was the local supermarket in Florida. And that's true. But, I mean, apples really come from trees, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about, let's first start with JC Food. You're the director of operations. What is that and what do you do?
JC Food is, it's actually my family company. It's a private school food service company, and it was started by my father, and really has been him and his business has really been my inspiration in all the work that I've done in my career so far. My dad was a classically trained chef. Grew up in Brooklyn, and he started working, he was working at the Four Seasons in the late 70s, and he had started having his family, me and my sister, and he wanted to be able to come to softball games and dance recitals and be home for Christmas Eve. And so he found a job at a school on the Upper East Side, the Brearley School, that was looking for a chef manager. And my dad got the job and started cooking as he would have at the Four Seasons.
Wow.
Seasonal, from scratch food, things that he learned from his classic training, things his mom used to make for him, and that really caught fire. And he was so ahead of his time in the early 80s doing that they're an all-girls school, and so the boys' school wanted the same kind of food, and then someone else had another kid in another school, and his business just grew very much from word of mouth and from people loving his food and starting to see food in a different way. So that's been my father's business and the business that I grew up in my whole life.
Yeah, and that seems so different from the standard food school food service that goes on today, the things we've seen on television with Jamie Oliver,
sure.
where everything comes from a box mm-hmm. that the food service professionals, they just mix with water and cook it, and it's all manufactured, synthetic, scary stuff.
Yes. What's amazing is my dad was doing this work sort of at the exact time that that trend was really taking hold of school food. So when I was a kid and people used to ask me what my dad did, it was really hard for me to explain because people didn't know, like, ew, your dad makes school
mm-hmm.
food.
Ew.
And I would have to explain that it's not what you think, and people didn't really get it. Now the sort of the eyes have come into the cafeteria kitchen, people are understanding it, and the trend is starting to turn, but it's definitely a slow moving train.
Right. And there's plenty of evidence that shows that children behave better, they learn better when they have real food, excuse me.
Absolutely. I mean, for schools not to look at nutrition of their students as a critical part of academics, test scores, disciplinary acts, absenteeism, everything across the board is affected by, you know, we know this, that it's affected by what you eat, but it really affects a teacher's experience and an administrator's experience with their students as well.
Yeah. Okay. So you're involved with that, and then you founded Veggiecation. So let's talk about that, because I think that sounds really fun.
Thank you.
Veggiecation.
Yes. It has been a lot of fun. It's been quite an adventure over the past 4.5 years. I came into the company because I was doing personal training and teaching yoga and really into fitness and nutrition when I graduated from college with a business degree in 2005. And my dad's business was growing, and he said to me, you know, can you come on and help me with the growth of the business and to be the advocate for health in the company? And so it was a perfect fit for me. And my dad's one of my best friends, so it was a good fit for us. And I came in like gangbusters trying to advocate for whole wheat everything and bringing, you know, really trying to market and sell vegetables to kids with no marketing materials. So I came at it from that approach because, like I said, I came out of school with a business degree and I believe in the power of marketing. So I was also meeting with reps from the big food companies that had their great marketing strategies and different schemes that they did to work themselves into schools. And I said, well, this is not fair if they're going to sell processed foods with all this marketing materials and I have nothing to sell my Whole Foods with. Mm-hmm. So I started Veggiecation as more of a marketing tool at first. I also wanted to get into the classroom, and the teachers that I spoke with at a lot of these great independent schools throughout the city here said, we don't really have time for nutrition education. We still have to teach literacy and math and science and social studies, and there's no time for nutrition.
Right.
So it was my job in the lunchroom to create this education and this marketing.
I'm just thinking of someone, and I'm wishing her name would come to me. she's from Cornell. She used to work with T. Colin Campbell. I think she has, it's like the Food Institute or something.
Cornell's at
Dimas. Dr. Dimas.
I believe I know the name.
And her name, and Antonia Dimas. Thank you, memory.
Yes.
I'm not losing it yet. Okay. Anyway, she had put out a 24-week curriculum, Food is Elementary. Are you familiar with that?
I have heard of that, yeah.
Because it was exactly what you had heard. The teachers were saying, we don't have time. Teachers are overwhelmed. I mean, our whole school system is just crazy to begin with. And they don't have time to add to their curriculum. And so she came up with food education that would fit into their curriculum, into their standard subjects. And that's how she managed to teach healthy food.
I did the same thing when we first started out. We called it a classroom companion. Mm. And I actually went to a friend of mine who was a teacher in New York. He had worked in public schools and had taught first, second, and third grade. And I said to him, what would be helpful to you? How could I actually do what you need to do, accomplish this, and also accomplish my own goals? So he said, if I had lessons with just, you know, a lesson suggestion, supporting academic material, something that was fun, cute, colorful, and then also was lined up to my standards. So I knew what I was accomplishing academically. I could use that. So him and I developed over one summer these three classroom companions for first, second, and third grade with just a ton of supporting academic resources for the program. So we do have an academic piece to our program.
Well, that's very nice. And you're competing with major corporations that have materials that they give the schools for free.
Mm-hmm.
And schools are so strapped for cash that they love free materials. But for them, they're actually marketing their unhealthy products at the same time.
Yes.
So where do people get this material? Do they have to go to Veducation and contact you and have you come to their school to get your program? How does that all work?
Well, our program, it really started with the academic program, and we tried to make that really inexpensive for schools and reproducible materials for them. So it was the program was initially $69.99 for them to have the classroom companions and all these reproducible academic materials. To be perfectly honest with you, I found that even making this so easy and turnkey for teachers, it still had a hard time of finding the niche in the classroom. And what we started doing at the same time, because I'm all about the food, as you are, we were doing tastings with kids of the different vegetables and characters that we had. And then I started working with the Whole Foods on the Upper West Side of Manhattan here and started teaching healthy kids cooking classes once a month. That changed the game for us. That seeing kids and the way that they interacted with vegetables and herbs and beans that they have never seen before, never touched, never smelled, never tasted, and the way that they were empowered by making their own recipe, that opened my eyes to what this program was all about and what we needed to do. So that's become the focus of Veducation. We're a culinary nutrition education program now because cooking skills, I think, are an essential life skill. And schools, what we're able to do for schools now is either have one of our certified Veducator educators, as we call them, our instructors, who are trained and are equipped to teach classes there. We have them all over the U.S. and Canada now, and soon in South Africa and Korea, which we're really excited about. Or what we've also been doing for several groups locally is training teachers. Doing professional development, teaching them how to engage their students with these healthy hands-on activities. Also, some nonprofits have had us do trainings for them as well. So it can be a sustainable program that schools don't have to keep paying for.
Now, I know here in Manhattan, there are many homes that have the most gorgeous kitchens you have ever seen anywhere, decked out with all clad and Le Creuset, all my favorite pots and pans, and they've never been used. And nobody knows where their kitchens are. So, I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that kids haven't, you know, don't know what these foods are and haven't had them because their parents don't really know much about them either.
It's true. And this, you know, this is a complete problem for all levels of society, all socioeconomic levels. Everyone is suffering from this problem. And it's, you know, it's not just here in the city and urban life. I see it out in suburban life as well. We've just had this same message and same experience from people all over the country that people have just gotten so far away from their own kitchen that they don't know. There's a generation, I think, of parents that are uncomfortable with cooking. And that's why we need to change this with the kids.
Well, the parents are uncomfortable. They're also, many of them, overwhelmed.
That too.
And overworked. And both parents are working, and it's really hard to have time for the kids, have time for the jobs. Everybody's tired. And to think about what to make in the kitchen, it seems, and I'm making air quotes here as I'm talking, but it seems easier to go for the convenience foods, the prepared foods, and be done with it. I don't think it's necessarily easier, you know, and maybe you have some thoughts on that.
Yes,
but it's a big challenge.
I agree with you. It's definitely not easier when you have the skills. When you have the skills to prepare simple, healthy meals, it's actually a lot less expensive, which, you know, we're working so hard to create a savings account to be able to pay our bills. And a lot of takeout or processed foods are going to be more expensive, not only for our budget, but then also down the road for our health and our health care. For me, both of my parents were entrepreneurs. So I was, from the time I was in middle school, I was home alone a lot. And I would come home from the bus, and I lived in New Jersey, and I would get off the bus and come home and be responsible for my own snack after school. And I was always hungry and doing my homework and such. And because my dad always had me in the kitchen and was always teaching me how to make things, I could come home and whip up a really delicious snack for myself and not be a problem. Or if my mom had to work late, you know, I could make dinner and be happy with that, you know, at 12 years old. That's a great thing to be able to do.
Absolutely. Okay, so you work with kids, and I want to know a number of things. What are the things that they've really enjoyed, and what are the things that they've really not liked?
I you might not believe me on this, but there actually have been very few things that they haven't liked.
I believe you.
Okay, good. what we do with our recipes, I have an amazing chef, Chef Nancy Burgos Jackson, who has been working with JC Food for, I'm not going to say how long, she'll kill me, a long time. And she has two beautiful twin daughters. And she has helped me. She's been integral in creating these recipes that are what we call classroom style. So they can be done anywhere with our portable cooking kits. And they don't require a kitchen because most schools or community centers don't have one. And that are simple, that are easy, that are plant-based, that are affordable. And what we do is we test them at a summer camp that she runs in Brooklyn every summer. So the ones that don't work don't make it into the recipe book. But for the most part, I mean, we do raw salads. We do what I call lettuceless salads quite often. Because, you know, I've always been someone who's eating a lot of greens and salads, and I just get a little bit bored with a leafy green salad sometimes. So I like the crunchy stuff. So we've made salads that kids really love that's just the crunchy stuff. Green apples and celery and grapes with a honey Dijon vinaigrette that they've made themselves. We do a lot of green smoothies. Kids absolutely love that. Anything in the blender. Kids go crazy for pestos, bean dips, all different kinds of spreads. Kids go crazy for that kind of stuff.
Wow. Now, what about the greens? What about leafy greens?
Oh,
and
we
salads?
Don't worry. We don't leave them out. We do make, you know, some leafy green salads. Some of our characters are kale and spinach and romaine lettuce and cabbage and green leaf lettuce. So we definitely work with our leafy greens, but then we also do creative things, like green leaf lettuce wraps.
I love them.
Yeah, so good. And also putting them in green smoothies. We make our shamrock smoothie with the kale and a sweetheart smoothie with the spinach and things like that, that kids really, really respond to. And at first they're a little freaked out that it's green, but once you've educated them on the health benefits, and not just, we don't talk about folate and vitamin K, adults don't care what that is. They care that it's going to give them brain power and make their hair healthy and shiny and make their skin look good and prevent pimples and all these kinds of things that beauty products use to sell for, sell their products. We actually can say that for real with our vegetables.
They do care about protein, though, because that's like the only thing people seem to know about.
Yep, that's true. But, you know, then we let them know about how much protein are in their vegetables. And that's really exciting for them as well.
Right. Now, where did kids learn to not like vegetables?
I think it's a societal thing.
I'm hundreds of years ago, did kids like vegetables?
You know, I can't say because I've only been on the earth for about 3 decades now. So I don't know. But I do know. I mean, I do know the way that my grandparents eat. We lived in a two-family house, so I grew up with my grandparents, who were first-generation Italian-Americans, and actually my grandfather had a farm in Queens, if you can imagine that. The pictures are amazing. So he grew up on a farm, and he tended to the vegetables, and so we always had vegetables in our house, and then he turned our garden in New Jersey into his own little farm. And I grew up tending to the herbs and the green beans and the zucchini with him. I think exposure is so key. And our society just throws chicken fingers and pizza and mozzarella sticks in front of kids. And there's nothing green. So it's an exposure issue. They're not familiar with it. The research shows us that it's 12 to 15 exposures to a new food for a child to become comfortable with it and to accept it on their own and choose it on their own.
12.
12 to 15.
Okay.
That's a lot
I've
of exposure.
I once heard it was 8, but 12 to 15, that is a lot. Yeah.
And I think what happens is parents see their kids, you know, they try to give them a pepper.
I don't want it.
I don't like it.
I don't like it. It's green.
Mm-hmm. And then that's it. My kid doesn't like peppers. And then that's over. Peppers are dead in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not true. You know,
right.
I
see parents sometimes when it's a vegetable that they don't like, they don't even realize they're giving the message to the kid, oh, you won't like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, we have our own biases. And I always say to the kids, I say, you know, if you don't try something new, you don't know if you're going to like it or not. And you might not like it because not everybody likes everything. And that's okay because that's what makes us unique and special. But you might find that you do like it and then you found your new favorite food. And so kids really, they get that. They understand it.
Mm.
And it oftentimes takes some of the holdouts over the hump of not trying something, making them nervous.
Well, yeah. So now you say that your JC Food works with independent schools.
Yes.
So what's the difference between independent schools and public schools, and why do you work with one versus the other?
My dad's always worked with independent schools because his model his business model works for independent private schools. It would not work for public schools. Having the knowledge that I do about school food and about working with kids and healthy foods brought me to the Coalition for Healthy School Food. And that's an organization that focuses primarily on public schools.
Hmm.
Public schools is a whole different animal when it comes to budgeting and regulation. And so my dad always wanted to do the food that he wanted to do and be successful at that.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't want to have to make compromises.
And he found a market for that.
Exactly. So it worked for him. And I tried a couple times to push us into public schools. And then I realized how horrible that is on certain levels from a business perspective. So I sort of have satisfied that need to get involved with public schools by being a big part of the coalition and becoming the co-chair of the board. And what we do is we work directly with the Department of Education here in New York City, with the Office of School Food, to promote more plant-based options as actual meals on the city menus.
So what positive things have happened so far?
Some really positive things have happened, particularly in the last 2 years. When those big regulation changes happened through the USDA, the city gave us the option of the alternative menu. And so there's the classic menu that has your chicken tenders and your mozzarella sticks for lunch, a lot of beef and pork and things like that. And then there's the alternative menu that has no beef, no pork, no mozzarella sticks, no fried chicken fingers
at
all.
What else is there?
it's a beautiful menu. There's a lot of greens, a lot of roasted sweet potatoes. Mm. There's 2 days that are plant-based, purely plant-based foods. So there's a big focus on beans, adding more herbs into recipes. And for schools that have nutrition education as part of their school environment, the menus have been really, really successful.
And do kids have to choose in advance if they want the alternative menu, or that's something
it's not
on
a choice
daily
for
basis?
It's a choice that the school makes. Hmm. And it's really ultimately the principal's choice, but something that can come as an initiative from the PTA.
So they do one or the other?
Yes, it's either the classic menu or the alternative menu. We've also had the great success we had last year that we announced around this time last year of the first public vegetarian
school. In Queens!
Yes, Flushing, Queens, PS244.
Let's hear it for Queens. I live in Queens.
I was born in Queens, so I was very, very proud of 244, and I'm blown away with that school.
So what's happening there? What's the progress that's happening?
The progress is phenomenal. They did do a study on the BMI. In the school, mm-hmm. and BMI is down. And
this is before and after?
Yes.
Now, I had read, I mean, some of these kids were more plant-friendly than your average school.
I think, yes, the culture in the school, there's a lot of very strong Asian influence from a lot of Indian families and also a lot of Chinese families as well. So introducing beans and tofu was not totally crazy to them. Mm-hmm. They had been exposed to it at a young age. But it did take about 3 years to get to the point of 5 plant-based days.
Wow.
It was a slow progression. It started with 2 plant-based days, then 3, then 4, then 5. And it was a lot of community education. We did, every year we would do 2 family dinner nights where we would serve a plant-based meal and we would do education on processed foods and the importance of plant-based foods. And then also the principal there, Bob Groff, is extremely committed to having nutrition education as part of every day for these students. It's incredible. You see the projects on the wall are all about fitness and wellness, and it's really incredible.
Okay, so their BMI is down. And
yep. I believe test scores are also up for that school. And they have been the inspiration for 2 other schools in New York City to also go vegetarian this year.
Who are those?
There's the Peck Slip School.
Where's that?
It's actually in the Chancellor's Building downtown. And please forgive me, I don't remember the name of the other school.
That's okay. Wow.
So, yeah, that was
go
a huge
go New
problem.
York.
Yeah, very, very exciting.
Woo! That's really good news. Okay, now Whole Foods. So you do your culinary classes for kids in the Whole Foods.
Yes. We started with, like I said, the Upper West Side. We were doing it once a month, every third Tuesday of the month at 4 o'clock. And that became so successful there that in 6 months, we were in 23 Whole Foods markets in the Northeast region. And that is really what grew our program, made people aware of what we were doing. And since then, I now have been, because I couldn't possibly teach classes in 23 stores, I started training our instructors. And in last August, launched what we call the Vegetator Educator Training Program. So now our instructors can work independently and actually make a living doing what they love.
Wow, that's great.
So
that's wonderful.
Really exciting.
Whew. So what do kids make in these programs?
Like I said, some of our lettuceless salads. They also make things like lettuce wraps. They make green smoothies. They make all different kinds of pestos. We have one that I really love in the spring called Minty Pisto, which is made with fresh mint leaves, olive oil, and peas, green peas. That's amazing on pasta. It's so good. and then also learning to make green smoothies and, you know, talking to them about how they can start their day. Spinach smoothies in particular is a good mood food, so how it's a perfect way to start your day and get 3 of your 5 servings of fruits and vegetables in the morning with fruit and strawberries, spinach and strawberries.
So you're telling me that most of these kids didn't originally eat like this that come and take your classes? Because I'm thinking the parents that know about Whole Foods and take their kids and shop in Whole Foods have an edge already on healthier foods, assuming.
You would think that most of them have been exposed to it. Some, yes, and sometimes we get kids that are cooking in the kitchen with their parents. And
I know my nephew and niece, they do a lot of cooking.
Yeah, and that's fantastic. And then we have some kids that parents have sought this out as a solution for them because they are frustrated. I had a mom in Yonkers who was teaching a class there on Sundays once a month, and the mom came up to me after about 3 or 4 months. I kept seeing her and her son, and she said, I have to thank you. We have our vegetation list on the refrigerator, and we would do 2 new vegetables or beans, herbs every month. And she said, and every month now we get to add 1 or 2 new vegetables that we know it's our vegetation list, and we know that he will eat them. So we've got peppers, we've got carrots, we've got chickpeas, things like that. And that just really... You know, that little anecdotal things like that are sort of keep me going
really
every day.
Yeah, really good. Now, is there a cost for people to take this program at Whole Foods?
No, it's a free program that we
awesome.
Offer at Whole Foods. So it's we're in several of the stores throughout the Northeast region. I think your niece saw us at the Danbury store in Connecticut, which is one of the newer stores for Whole Foods here. And, yeah, they can just find out about it and sign up.
That is so fabulous. Okay, so I think we've come to the end. I just have one question. What's the favorite, the ultimate favorite that the kids love?
The ultimate, my never fail, is parsley lemon pesto.
Parsley lemon pesto.
Right?
Delicious.
Kind of surprising.
And they dip their veggies in it or
they
do whatever
they
want.
They dip their veggies in or we'll do like a whole wheat pita bread with it. Or, you know, sometimes I'll get a whole grain roll or something like that, because kids really love to be able to dip the bread and soak up the pita, the pesto with it. It's absolutely my favorite recipe that we have. I'm sure you can find it on our website, veggiecation.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
I'm hungry.
Put it on everything. It's so good.
That sounds great, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About
Thank
Food.
You.
People can find you at
veggiecation.com. It's VeggieCation.com.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a little break, and we will be right back with Brendan Brazier. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for a little more of It's All About Food. And I do not want to waste another moment. I want to bring on my next guest because I know he's really, really busy. And I want to get to all the good stuff. So, Brendan Brazier, welcome to It's All About Food. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Karen.
Yeah, so you are just Superman, aren't you? You
well,
are. Come on, you're Superman. You look like Superman.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
You're super awesome. So in case people don't know about Brendan, he is an incredible athlete and a great entrepreneur, a former professional Ironman triathlete and a two-time Canadian 50-kilometer ultra-marathon champion, and he's now a successful performance nutrition consultant, a best-selling author. He's got the Thrive book series and the Vega line of plant-based nutritional products. And when people need information about athletic performance and nutrition, they seem to find Brendan because he knows just about everything people need to know. And you've got a new cookbook out called Thrive Energy Cookbook, and that's what we're going to be talking a little bit about today.
Well, thanks. That's quite the intro.
Well, you are, and you're amazing, Brendan. Let's just put it that way. Nope. It's always so inspiring to see what the human body can do. And athletes of all kinds are just very inspirational. And whenever I talk to an athlete, especially a vegan athlete, I always want to go out and exercise a little bit more. So thanks for that. Now, This is a great book. In the intro, I really appreciated what you did and some of the concepts that I just want to touch briefly on. The first thing I love about this book is your dedication. You've got a great picture of your grandmother on the Lions Gate Bridge in Vancouver. I love that picture.
Yeah, that was a good find. My dad came across that when he was going through a stack of photos, and her father was a photographer, so that's how we got that, because obviously back then, I think it was 1942, not a lot of people were carrying around cameras, so
right.
You really didn't get many good shots from then.
I only wish it was in color, because I'm always wondering to myself, which is more beautiful, the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge or the Lions Gate Bridge? To me, they're very similar in look and color schemes around them. They're just both so breathtaking. So I really appreciated that picture because I love the Lions Gate Bridge. Okay. Now, the next thing that I like about what you do is you talk in, when it comes to nutrition, you use very similar terms as when we talk about the economy and the value of the dollar or any currency. But instead, you're talking about energy and nutrition, and I really love what you've done with that. Can we talk a little bit about biological debt? It's brilliant.
Sure. So biological debt is something that it's something I guess I just kind of was trying to put into words, and really what I mean by that is the state your body's left in once your body has used borrowed energy. And what I mean by borrowed energy is stimulants, energy that comes from stimulants. So coffee, of course, being probably the most commonly used, but also sugary foods that give you energy right away. And it does work. Coffee, of course, works. You drink it, you get energy. But the downside is that it eventually catches up with you. Your adrenals you pump out cortisol and adrenaline, and you get it and you use it and it feels good, but then it does go away, and it actually goes away even more so than if you hadn't drank the coffee in the first place. So you're left with some debt there, and you do have to pay that back. You know, it's not free energy. It does take its toll on the adrenal gland. So just trying to put it into perspective so people understand, yes, coffee's not necessarily a bad thing. And, you know, as an athlete, I know you can drink a bit of coffee and get more energy and work out harder because of it, and therefore boost your fitness in less time, which is great. But there needs to be an understanding that it's not free. You do end up having to pay it back. We have to make sure you nourish your adrenals well by eating well, and that you can handle that tax on it, basically, is what it is. It's kind of like shopping with a credit card. You get something now, but you pay for it later, and that's kind of the way I like to look at it. So things don't get out of hand. You don't get into that biological debt.
Well, so many of us in North America really are used to that credit card in debt syndrome, and we do it too as well with our food. But I know I've heard many people say that it's good to drink a little coffee before you go out for a run. Are you telling me that I shouldn't be doing that? I don't drink coffee, but I'm just, that's just what I've heard.
Yeah, well, not necessarily. I think it needs to be used selectively. I think that you definitely don't want to get into the habit of needing it just to function in the morning, because then you become dependent on it, and that's never a good situation to be dependent on anything. But yeah, if you use it selectively before a workout, if it's going to be a really intense workout or a longer workout, then yeah, a bit of coffee or green tea or something that's a little less harsh is better, in my opinion. But it's okay to stimulate the adrenals and draw from that if you get something in return. And the return, if you have it before a key workout, is a greater level of fitness, because you can perform better in that workout. So that's a pretty good trade-off. Or if it's a big project at work, you're getting a little worn out, and you know that you can work better, you can think more clearly if you have a little bit of coffee or some green tea or something that is a stimulant, that's fine. But I think where the problem comes is when people become dependent on it, and like I say, need it to just function in the morning. What I would suggest for them is to slowly wean themselves off of that, so that they're not in that state anymore, and their body will actually recognize it more easily, and they won't need to have as much of it to get the same effect, which is then good, because you get into less biological debt, yet you still get the same benefit. So you want to kind of clean up your diet and become less dependent on those stimulants through through a few different ways I talk about in the book, like just getting away from it. Eating off the greens, for example, and depending less on sugary foods for a while.
I'm a believer. There are a lot of young people today. We know that women, especially young women, even older women, but young women are very influenced by what they see in the media in terms of models and pictures and how they should look. And unfortunately, there's bulimia and anorexia and a lot of food disorders, and it's spilling over with the young men. And I recently was talking to a couple of young guys, teens, like 17 and 19 or 20, somewhere around that age, and they're stunning-looking guys. They're really fit, but they're thinking that they're not, and they're thinking that they need to bulk up, they need to look like certain movie stars, and I think it's a really sad statement, but the thing is, you've got a recipe here for exercise and nutrition for people to look great, feel great inside and out.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, the way I look at it, coming from an endurance athlete background, is it's all about function. You want to be strong, but you don't want any extra weight that you don't need. That's not actually going to help move you forward more efficiently. And of course, bigger muscles doesn't mean more efficiency. In fact, it means the opposite. And bodybuilding is a very unique sport. It's measured not on function, but on visual appeal. So bodybuilding is the only sport that's just measured on how people look. So symmetry, definition, size, and so on. But it's very different, obviously, from functionality. And endurance sport, of course, is all functionality. So I really just train for function. And with that comes a certain aesthetic. And, to some people, it does look too skinny. But I'm okay with that. And the top endurance athletes, I think, would would be a little skinnier looking than what most people think is a picture of health. So that's kind of the nature of high-level sports in that situation. And I think, like you say, it's, you know, a lot of these people, of course, these young men, they see bodybuilders and they see people in movies and magazines and so on. And keeping in mind, too, a lot of that, it's a very short time. Like, people peak for photos. Like, they train for months and months to get to that shape. They get their photo taken for a magazine or whatever, and then that goes away. So it's not even sustainable in many cases, is what I'm saying. And also, too, of course, lighting and all those types of things do can make things appear different to what they really are.
You tell a really lovely story about someone who learned a lot about your diet and nutrition and lifestyle, and you ultimately became partners, and he's responsible for a lot of the wonderful recipes, I think, in this book. But one of the things that I loved about the story, and I don't want to tell the whole story because I want people to get this book because it's a beautiful book and there's a lot of wonderful information in it. But I'm talking about Johnny Curran. Is that how he says his name?
Yeah, so Johnny is a chef, a classically trained chef, and I met him a few years back when he had just come out of a pretty deep sickness, and he had done it by reading my first book called Thrive, and he made a bunch of recipes in it, and he felt really good, and he'd never eaten that way before, and he actually was so impressed by it that he created a juice bar called Thrive Juice Bar that was making the recipes that were in the book. And he just did this without me even knowing about it. And then he told me, and I was really flattered. So I thought, well, that's great. You know, he's really trying to get good food out there to more people. So we talked about it and, decided to, do more of this. And there's one location now. It's in Kitchener, Waterloo, which is just outside of Toronto. And we want to do some more. It's Thrive Energy Lab is what it's called now. And, it's just another way to make it convenient, make it taste good. And Johnny, with his chef know-how and me with my nutrition know-how, I felt it was a good, you know, there's some good synergy there because, of course, you know, I like the way my recipe tastes, but I think that, you know, if a chef kind of puts his touches on it, it's going to appeal to a broader group of people. So that's what we went for in this book, is something that's functional, yet also, you know, made by a chef.
Well, the results are really stunning, but I want to say that it's a testament to you and your whole attitude and perspective on life, because I think some other people in the same situation would have seen someone who had taken the name Thrive, which you have come up with and use in all of your lines and books and things, and he was using it in a restaurant, and somebody might have just gone totally negative and say, you can't do this. But instead, you know, you realize all the good in it and became partners. And I think the results haven't just doubled. They've become exponentially better. So that's just another pat on the back for you, Brendan.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's the way I like to do things. You know, he has the best intentions to try and get good food to more people. So, you know, you can't fault a guy for that. There's, you know, if you want to look at things closely, I'm sure there's some copyright infringement and stuff, but, you know, it really doesn't bother me if, you know, he's just another person getting the message out there. That's, you know, that's what's important.
Right, and that's what's beautiful about it. Okay, Brendan, I know you're busy, and I know you have to get back to your meeting, so I wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk a little bit about Thrive, the Energy Cookbook, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, take care.
Okay, you too.
Okay, thank you. Wow, that was Brendan Brazier, and I'm going to say it again. This book, Thrive Energy Cookbook, is truly, truly stunning, and you can find out more about Brendan at brendanbrazier.com. That's BrendanBrazier.com, and very stunning. Okay, so we have a little bit more time left, and I wanted to bring on another guest from Compassion Over Killing. And I hope I pronounce your name right. Is it Jaya?
Jaya. Yes, you got it right.
Jaya.
Thank you.
Okay. Jaya, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, well, it was very last minute, and I'm glad that we were able to work it out because the timing seems to be really good. Can we talk about the U.S. Veg Week and the 7-Day Veg Pledge?
We sure can. And first, I want to thank you so much for partnering on the campaign. We're thrilled to have you as a partner again this year. For those who are not familiar with U.S. Veg Week, it is our 6th year celebrating U.S. Veg Week, which this year will run from April 21st to the 27th. Earth Day is April 22nd.
And My birthday. Yes.
What a great day to celebrate. I love that.
Me too.
Well, we're very excited because we actually use Earth Day as a hook every year because eating vegetarian foods has such a tremendous impact on the environment, as well as our health and, of course, for animals as well. So the concept of Veg Week is basically to celebrate the benefits and flavors of vegetarian eating. Restaurants come on board from around the country to offer specials on their delicious vegan fare. Events are held by volunteers throughout the nation. And the crux of the campaign is a 7-day vegetarian pledge, which thousands of Americans take, along with legislators, which is really exciting. We have more than 40 legislators have signed on for this year's campaign to take a 7-day veg pledge. Cory Booker just signed on yesterday, senator from New Jersey, and we're thrilled about all of the participants.
Wow, that's great. Because our government really needs to know a lot more about vegetables.
We agree. We think that it's a great opportunity for the legislators and elected officials to get involved so that they can set a good example for their constituents, but also that when they go vote on legislation, they're more conscious of some of these issues related to sustainable eating, community health, and, of course, animal welfare.
So you've been doing this for 6 years.
We have.
What are some of the positive outcomes from politicians who've taken the pledge?
You know, we were very excited. Some of them have actually stuck with it. There's Senator Jamie Raskin, who actually helped us establish the campaign 6 years ago, and he has stuck with his pledge to this day, which is very exciting. We had somebody else, Delegate Shane Robinson, who pledged last year, and he has actually stayed vegan since his pledge last year.
No way.
So we've seen some really great results, and, of course, from the public as well. We get testimonials every year. We send out a survey, and we get amazing feedback of people who are able to now live more compassionate, healthful lives due to the advice that we give throughout the campaign. We do a lot of hand-holding, a lot of great emails with support, information, tips, recipes. We provide coupons from amazing sponsors. So there's a lot of resources available to people who participate so that they can make the transition very easily. And because that transition so easily, a lot of them want to stick with it throughout the future.
That sounds pretty good. Well, I'm more and more inclined to think we need to make more change at the government level. I've always been a believer that the grassroots, changing people one at a time, is really very important, and I continue to work along that way. But the government has so much control and so much power and is so off base in so many ways in their decision making. And unfortunately, they're all so focused on staying in their jobs and campaigning in order to get the funds to do so that they don't take enough time to learn about their communities and what really needs to change. And there's so many bad decisions made with our food policy that they need to get educated. And this is a great way for them to do that.
I think that's so true, and it's a systemic problem, and I do think that food policy is coming more into the minds of politicians. They're realizing that people do care about where their food is coming from, how animals are treated, how environment is affected by these issues. More and more people are going to farmers markets simply to try to get better food for their families. And so I think that a campaign like this is a really great way to sort of combine all of the important lessons about vegetarian eating, but also to make it really fun. And the legislators that have signed on for this year are really taking a stand, I think, to show their communities that they want to support what their constituents are saying is important to them. We have 12 U.S. representatives this year, so some very high-profile figures, congresspeople from across the country, as well as state and local elected officials. And we've heard from all of them that they are very excited to participate because they themselves want to learn from what the campaign can teach them and show their community, really prove to their community that these are priorities for them as well.
For me, I came to this way of eating a long time ago because I don't believe in killing animals. I don't believe in killing anything. And that's always been the primary motivation and my primary inspiration. And of course, along the way, I've learned that there's no reason not to eat this way. We're learning that it's the healthiest way to eat when we're eating a whole foods plant-based diet. And we're learning that it's best and gentlest on the environment. So it's like just a super win for everything all around. And I'm always looking for whatever angle it takes to get people interested in eating this way. But I do it to minimize pain and suffering and exploitation. That's the primary thing for me. But recently, we've been hearing more about climate change in the news. And it's funny because I was talking a few weeks ago or months how it's barely in the news. And now there's a new report that's leaking and coming out with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And people are starting to talk about it, which is a good thing. I imagine that some of the representatives in our government are a little more tuned in with the connection between food and climate change.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I hope that more people are paying attention. You hear a lot about reducing emissions and sort of some more palatable ways of affecting climate change. But really, the most significant thing we can do is simply leave animals off of our plates. It's a very easy thing to do. It's something that all of us have control over. And you were talking a minute ago about how the biggest impetus for you to eat the way you do is actually to spare animals. And I think that's a wonderful reason. It's actually my personal reason as well. But I would also argue that choosing vegan foods is actually the tastiest way to eat. I think that the products that are available now are such convincing substitutes. We've got many amazing sponsors who are going to be showing off what delicious items they're providing to the public now to make transitions more easy. But in addition, just the opportunity to cook at home, I love it. I found that I've never been so creative in the kitchen. People sometimes worry about what they might be giving up, but in fact, eating vegan has helped me expand my own horizons in cooking. Mm-hmm. There are foods, international foods in particular, that I never would have come across had I not started to eat this way, and I feel like it's just been a party for my taste buds. I've been so lucky.
Party for the taste buds! I agree. Well, more about this climate change thing. If people are concerned about climate change, if people are concerned about the environment, and if, I mean, I know my listeners are interested in healthy food and plant foods, but each of us as individuals, the ones especially who are tuned in, need to do more. We all need to do more. So whatever we're doing, it's great, but we all need to do more because there are plenty of people who aren't doing anything, and we need all to do more. So one of the things that we're talking about U.S. Veg Week right now and this Veg Pledge, and for all that are listening, I encourage you to go to, what is it, usvegweek.com?
Exactly. It's usvegweek.com, and people can sign up there for the pledge. It's a very, very easy form to fill out. They can elect to receive daily tips emails that will have free recipes, links to coupons, lots of great ideas for them, dining tips to help them, things about saving money, eating vegetarian foods, lots of great ideas. And they may also elect to receive a veg starter pack, which will have even more of that information. And if they pledge by this Friday, they can ensure to receive it by April 21st, which is the kickoff date. So if you want to get your kitchen stocked, head to usvegweek.com and you can sign up there and make sure that you have everything you need before the week begins.
Right. So if you want to get your friends and family who aren't on this diet yet, who aren't tuned in, who are kind of difficult when it comes to eating healthy food, here's an opportunity to kind of link the conversation on climate change these days and what's going on our plates, and do your best to get your friends and family to take this pledge. It's just a week, and it's a great opportunity to learn a lot in a short amount of time, and it'll be great for everybody.
It is, and it, you know, getting friends and family on board is actually one of the most fun components of the pledge. If you even just encourage one person to do it with you, there's definitely strength in numbers. And we got a lot of feedback last year about people in offices that did it together as a team, family members did it as a team, significant others, and that really helps you stay on track, gives you a support system to share what you're eating, and it just makes the whole experience even more fun. So sign up for the pledge, bring a friend with you, and enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me, Jaya.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Okay. We've come to the end of the program. I just want to let you know I'm Karen Hartglass. My website is responsibleeatingandliving.com. I will not be doing the show next week because it is the Jewish holiday of Passover. And although I'm not a religious person, I love celebrating holidays and celebrating food. You could check out our recipe for vegan chopped liver right on the homepage of responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's one of my favorites and a perfect recipe coming up for the holidays. And I'll be back on my birthday, April 22nd. So have a delicious week.